Hello there. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, April 16th. I'm Ray Graff. Today, once again, we'll explore the quickly evolving world of artificial intelligence. Jim Hendler joins us today. He's the Tetherless World Chair of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences and the founding director of the Future of Computing Institute at RPI. Jim has advised the White House on IT issues. He's consulted cybersecurity matters on cybersecurity matters for state and federal governments, the private sector. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email. The number is 800-348-2551. Jim Hendler talks artificial intelligence. Your call's coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Artificial intelligence. Frankly, I'm sick and tired of hearing about it. Artificial this, intelligence that. I don't understand it. I'm still trying to get a handle on natural intelligence. But thankfully, with us today is Dr. Jim Hendler, Tetherless World Chair of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at the founding director of the Future of Computing Institute at RPI, director of the RPI-IBM Future Computing Research Collaboration, and chair of the Global Technology Council of the Association for Computing Machinery. Hendler has written a number of books and scientific articles on the topics of AI, cybersecurity, and the World Wide Web. If you have a question as we get into the conversation today, give us a call. 800-348-2551. That's the number, 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Jim Hendler, how are you?
I'm doing good, Ray. Good to see you.
Great to have you back and trying to make some sense of all this to me. Now, there was a time, you know, your bio changes all the time. And for a while, you were the head of the AI Research Collaborative, right? And now you're the grand poobah of the Future of Computing Institute. When will all these changes stop, and what do they mean?
Well, okay, let's not confuse two things. So okay. The AI Research Collaboration is our partnership with IBM.
Okay.
Between RPI and IBM, which has now been renamed the Future of Computing Research Collaboration.
Okay.
Now, then I was also of something an institute that had a different name that's now called the Future of Computing Institute to try to bring the two into a little bit more collaboration, but more closely alignment. And the real difference is for a while we were working with IBM strictly on AI sort of software and technology. Now we've moved to looking at some of the other problems. So that includes the fact that right now AI computers use a lot of energy, right? Particularly during the training phase. So when you use something like ChatGPT or something, that individual queries don't cost much, but training that thing, they ran for months on some of the biggest server farms in the country, and you know that used tons of electricity.
Yeah.
And there, without some kind of breakthroughs in sort of AI and AI chips that make them less energy intensive.
Right.
We're not going to be able to keep this stuff going. So that's number one.
Yeah.
And then number two is we got a quantum computer,
okay,
which we're still trying to figure out.
All right. There was an announcement about that recently. Tell me what, first of all, listen, I don't expect you to tell me that in a way that I could understand what this quantum business is all about, but just tell me what the end game is for this and why it's important.
Sure. Actually, you know, I finally found a pretty good way to describe sort of what the quantum stuff is really about in a certain way without getting into all the physics and stuff, which, frankly, I barely understand. But if I hit my hand on a table, which I'm doing in here, but we're on the radio, so
yeah, but it makes a great sound. Zach, okay, the engineer, is really excited about it, so let's not do that again.
So my hand doesn't go through the table.
Right.
But in theory, it could, because the atoms in my hand and the molecules and the little neutrons and electrons and all that stuff we talk about, really, most of that is just empty space.
Right.
Right. But the probability of that happening is so low that it's just not going to ever happen.
Right. And we've never seen it happen.
Yeah, and it would take, you know, one in a million, 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 keep going as many times as you want.
Right.
Possibility. Now, but now I'm a piece of mRNA that's been injected through a vaccination, and my job is to find a particular virus and bind to it and, you know, do something to make it ineffective. Okay. Now, that interaction happens down at the level of that quantum stuff. So in other words, it's happening at a physics level where the molecules are probabilistic. And so if you want to model that stuff really deeply, you need some kind of computation that can kind of simulate the quantum level of the world we live in, which is really the not the level where we think about the tables and things, but biomolecules, a lot of chemistry, some of the new nanomaterials are getting to where if we want to be able to make new materials to do these things, we have to be able to model them in a level we've never been able to model them before. And these machines, because they, quote, reason, unquote, at that level, are really good for that kind of modeling.
Okay, now, that all sounds good, and it sounds positive, but I have no idea how it differs, the so-called quantum computer differs in architecture from the way the old computers were, oh, let's say, back in the dark ages 10 years ago.
So, let me describe physically one little problem.
Okay.
The quantum chip is, roughly an inch and a half by an inch and a half. It sits in a cylinder that's about 3 or 4 feet wide and 6 or 4 feet deep. At the top of that cylinder, it's just room temperature. Down where that chip only works if it's very, very close to absolute zero. So what we call 0.17 millikelvins.
Wow.
Which is, the way it's usually described, is 200 times colder than outer space.
That's cold.
So, yeah. So problem number one is just getting these machines into a place where they can do the kinds of special things they need to do currently requires technologies like supercooling and things like that. So one of the differences is simply that for the chips to be able to work, they have to be in a very different environment. And the reason for that is because at a certain level, right, if I have two of these what are called qubits, I can make them so they relate to each other so that if one
qubit
of them is
being a binary code,
let's keep it binary for now.
Okay.
We can actually go beyond binary, but let's leave it for now. It's just one of them. I just have these two, and I say whatever the first one is, the second one will be the opposite. So if the first one's a zero, the second one will be a one, and first one's a one, the second one will be a zero. Now, until I look at one of them, until I measure them, they're both in both states. Right. This is that famous thing with the cat that's
right
in the box and all that.
It's alive, but it's dead, whatever.
Yeah. In a sense, at the quantum level, it's alive and dead at the same time. So
right,
our bits are zeros and ones and actually some other things between zeros and ones at the same time. So what you can do is you can keep a whole lot of those theoretically lined up in such a way that when you pick one, when you know what one is, that will cause you to know what all the other ones are.
Okay, to me, all right, now listen, we talk about quantum mechanics often on the astronomy shows and on the science forum. Right. To me, it all seems like a thought game. In other words, Jim, you could put your hand through this, but we know it's not going to happen in our lifetime. How can it be predictable enough to use in a practical way the knowledge that Jim could put his hand through the table?
So the key is not that Jim can put his hand through the table. The key is that we know enough about this molecular interaction for the same reason that your astronomers talk about quantum physics. It's really the same stuff. It's trying to figure out what's going on when things are very, 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 very small.
Yeah.
And we need a whole lot more varies in there. And so, again, if you have a cancer and I'm trying to design a cancer drug, that's not like putting my hand through the table. That's like figuring out how these different little bits interact with each other and that if this one gets pinged, it'll cause some stuff to happen to the other. And even that stuff's actually at a bigger level than the pure quantum, but it's really how things work in reality. We live in a quantum universe. Most of the time, we don't need to know that because most of what impacts our lives happens at sort of this bigger level, like me hitting the table.
But I mean,
but they can get, but some of the interactions, and these include interactions that happen in the middle of a star, which is why the astronomers care. These can be interactions that happen deep inside your body, which is why the biologists care. These can be things that have to do with how air flows over a piece of material on a wing that's been made out of some kind of new material. All of those things happen at that quantum level, and that's kind of what we're talking about.
Let me ask you a question. We're going to take a break here. When you talk to your students, do they have the vacant, glazed-over look that I have right now? Because I don't get it, man.
So let me put it this way, right? When I talk to my students, I have the glazed over look. And the best students are like these freshmen who have no idea what traditional computing is and come in and just start from scratch and say, hey, I get it. So we have a quantum club with about 50 students in it, and I'm trying to get them to explain to me what the heck's going on.
Fair enough. Let's take a break. Jim Hendler's our guest. We're going to find out what all of what Jim just said has to do with AI. Presumably it's something. We'll be back. Jim Hendler's our guest, and I'll be honest with you, my brain hurts after the first segment of the program. The number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Artificial intelligence is the topic today. We talked a little bit in the first segment here about the new quantum computer at RPI. Most of it was lost on your host, but he ain't that bright. Now, going back to our original topic for the show, how will the advanced computing power of this thing that's at minus 270 degrees below zero, how will that help in this artificial intelligence evolution?
So there's actually three things we're looking at. Okay, so one is, and this has gotten a lot of attention. So first of all, quantum computers are just now coming into real practice. In fact, we're the first university to ever get one of these IBM ones. There's one or two other universities that have something called a quantum annealer, which is related but not the same. And, you know, we're really just starting to explore what these things can really do, and they're going to have to be much, much bigger. So when I first started using computers, you know, I once went to... Oh, no, no, I can top that, right?
Really?
So I was working at Texas Instruments in, I guess it was about 79.
Okay.
And I went into what was then the biggest disk farm in the world, except for one the government owned that was, nobody was allowed in unless you were government. And it was like the size of a football field with all these big machines. They had disks running around and you had to like wear earphones. It was so noisy. My cell phone now holds more memory than that thing,
that
entire football field.
Yeah.
Okay, so with quantum, we expect it to start going up that hill, and whether it'll go as fast, faster, different, that there's a lot of discussion. But, you know, our computer has what's called 127 qubits. To really do a lot of the computations, you need a lot more. So we're looking actually at three different ways AI and quantum come together. So number one is one of the problems you have in the quantum computer. Okay, so we have this thing down there near zero gravity. Near zero temperature.
Right.
Right?
Absolute
and
zero.
We got to talk to it somehow. So we can't talk to it through electricity because electrical wires generate magnetism and heat.
Okay.
So we talk to it through microwaves. But microwaves, if you kind of have a microwave oven and put some metal in your microwave oven, you'll notice that that can generate some pretty bad effects too.
Don't do that at home. Just don't do that.
Yeah. So the key is you have to sort of talk to these machines in very specific ways. It's called pulsing. And each machine is a tiny bit different just because of little tiny bits of difference in the physics and the buildings they're in and on, we could go on. But what it basically boils down to is each of these is a little bit noisy. And so you have to run the same computation a whole lot of times. And then you kind of look at the curve to try to see what was the best.
Yeah.
And the more of that noise that you can get rid of, the better. Now, it turns out people are looking at, can the AI techniques be used to learn, as it were, the fingerprint of this particular machine and say, okay, so for this machine, when we see this happening, that's just noise and we can get rid of it. And when we see that happening, that's real computation, so we'll let it keep going.
So it makes its own notch filter, its own DSP, basically.
Okay.
It's notching out the noise.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah.
And so, but you have to, you have to learn it for particular machines, particular kinds of computations. AI is really good at that. So one of the things people are looking at now is, can AI give us a real improvement in the short term in making the quantum computers better? Second thing is, a lot of the stuff we do in AI mathematically is similar to what quantum computers can do. But the way the algorithms we use, the programs we run in AI, aren't anything like the programs that quantum computers run.
Interesting.
So a second piece of research going on now is, can we figure out how to take some of these AI techniques, get them to run on the quantum computer? Because in theory, once we have enough qubits, the quantum computer would learn it a lot faster, so say 10 years from now.
Okay, now let me stop you.
And a lot less energy.
Let me stop you there for a minute. You are obviously, you're in a different world. You're like a Star Trek character to me, all right? I only understand a very small portion of what you're saying. Jim Hendler, by the way, is our Star Trek character today. What's the practice? Right, you do all these things. You get it to think like AI, and you get AI to think like a quantum computer. To what end? What practical end?
So right now, again, to assuming we want to have ChatGPT-like things and face recognition, we can get into a lot of discussion about that.
Yeah.
But assuming we want to see the AI techniques get better, we have to find new ways of doing some of these computations that don't require all the energy and don't take months and months and months and billions of documents and, people who are paid a few dollars an hour to sit and go through these things and say, yes, that's a good answer, no, that's a bad answer, which is actually what goes on when they train these great big large language models, which is what most people think
like
about
ChatGPT?
These days. ChatGPT, okay. Also the things that make images, the things that do videos, more and more the things that do face recognition, et cetera, et cetera. So ways to do that learning much faster would have tremendous economic benefit.
Give me an example.
ChatGPT, you have to, if you want to compete with them, I hope you have a few billion dollars in your back pocket.
Yeah.
Right. In theory, if we could do these things as runs of a single computation of a quantum computer in the cloud, you don't need to have those billions of dollars. The billions of dollars are shared among all the users.
Okay.
Now, and so if you want to make not so much ChatGPT, but let's say we wanted to make WAMCGPT.
Okay.
So you could ask it any question you want about the station, things like that. And of course, station management would love it to have all the numbers. Yeah,
they love answering questions. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's great.
And for Vox Pop, instead of having to have people here, you could just...
Done. I'm ready for the couch. I'm all in, man.
No. We need the host.
Oh,
it's the person who asks the questions that becomes important.
It's
the things that give the answers that we can replace.
Right.
Okay. So being able to do that faster, cheaper, better would have tremendous impact on... So, for example, your medical records are all over the place and... You know, putting them together and learning from them could let us really help personalize health. But it's very difficult for a lot of reasons, some of which have to do with law and some of which have to do with computation. Now we're suddenly talking about something that, could conceivably in a decade or so be really knowing you, I mean, down to literally the DNA level. And so when something's wrong with you, they could figure out exactly what to do rather than say, try this and come back in a couple months if it doesn't work.
Jim Hendler's our guest. It's Artificial Intelligence Today, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Doesn't it terrify you, Jim Hendler? I know you move in different worlds than I do, but I'm terrified that all of everything, all my patterns, everything, things I don't even know, are suddenly distilled by a computer, and who knows who has it. This is a problem. Propriety of oneself.
Yes. So, in fact, you know, it's funny. We were just following a TED Radio Hour that was about face recognition and AI techniques.
Really?
They
I got to listen to that once
They talked about ethics, and they talked about exactly these kind of issues. But part of the problem is a lot of this has more to do with the law than with the technology. So what you're allowed to do with the AI, not so much what the AI can do, becomes important, right? And then, you know, you want to put limits on certain things. Of course, that gets into problems because you have big tech companies fighting, you know, giving lots of money to some politicians and on and on. But ignoring the political, right? So, for example, right now, releasing misinformation using an AI technique is typically not illegal, mm-hmm. right? Well, as people begin to learn more about what things do and what they look like and, you know, what AI fakes are, you know, hopefully people will get smarter
hopefully
about...
Hopefully murder's illegal and people have been doing it for thousands of years.
Right, but less so than they once did because we have ways of catching them, including, unfortunately, AI sometimes.
Interesting.
AI's good. The problem is there's some other issues. So I think that, and, you know, I spend a lot of my time trying to talk to policymakers and people like that and say, look, you know, a lot of this stuff is not rocket science, how we can start to control it. Europe is ahead of us. They're starting to actually put some of these laws into effect that say, hey, if you're going to use this kind of technology, it can only be used in this. So if you're going to use face recognition technology for police work, you could only use it for terrorism stuff because that's high enough risk that we're willing to take the error rate. Whereas if you're looking at individuals and saying, you know, do I think this person's a shoplifter or something, the AI is not ready for that yet. So there's a lot of those kind of debates going on. And the question is, you don't need any due process for a store to put in store can put in a face rec thing, say, okay, we're looking at all our shoppers and, you know, they've tried a lot of different things. So some of it is just targeted advertising, right? You walk in and they say, this looks like, I know your listeners can't see you, but Ray's about 30 years old, his beautiful head full of black hair.
Oh, my God.
This beard down to his navel. So if he walked in, they'd say, hey, this is a cool dude. You know, let's send him
to the beer aisle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Listen, man, I mean, bottom line is there hasn't been a technology that I know of invented in the history of the world that hasn't been used to kill people. I mean, this is ultimately what scares most of us.
Yep.
You know, and so we watched Saturday, and I watched with horror what Iran sent over to Israel. Drones and cruise missiles and everything else, and the technology was remarkable. I mean, Israel and the U.S. and U.K. did tremendous work. But you talk about these drone swarms. To me, that would be a terrible thing to fear with artificial intelligence.
So right now, most of the drones are a combination of human and machine together. So the human kind of programs the thing, is actually not flying it all the time, but is getting it going. And then when it gets to target, the human takes over. So is actually hitting the button that shoots the gun or whatever. We've had cruise missiles and things like that for a long time that use not really AI technology, but advanced technologies. And AI is one of them. So, yeah, I agree. You know, it's how we use this stuff. I signed on years ago to a letter that went to the UN, and the UN is still thinking about it on, you know, how much do humans have to be in the loop? You know, how much are we going to let the computers decide for themselves when they can, as it were, pull the trigger. So it's called lethal autonomous weapon systems. We already have certain levels of that that have been deployed, and the people who argue that the U.S. has to do research on this mostly argue because our enemies are going to do it, right? But if you look now at, for example, the laws that are being argued about and many have been passed on landmines, right? I mean, that's an old technology. It took us almost 40, 50 years to get to where people started saying, you know, this is a bad thing because after the war is over,
they're still there.
They're still there.
Yeah.
Well, so I think with AI, what we're trying to push for is to get some of that law in place beforehand. And it doesn't necessarily mean some company can't, some country can't develop something and use it, but we want them to become an outcast. We want them to be considered a, you know, pariah by the international rules of law, warfare and all those things. You know, I mean, I don't love that stuff at all. But
yeah,
if you're going to do, you know, somebody on the TED show, I caught his last part, and he said, you know, when you start making vehicles out of metal, you can make ambulances or you can make tanks.
Yeah.
And the real decision is among the ambulance makers and the tank makers, not the metal benders. Right. I think with AI, it's a little more subtle than that, and a lot of discussion is going on. In fact, there's something called the AI Alliance, which is led by a couple of very large companies and has hundreds of companies and universities involved that are really looking at how do we put some controls over these things? How do we make it open source so that people can actually know? So maybe you won't be able to look inside and see what the damn thing is doing, but maybe some of my students could look at the thing and say, hey, you know, why the heck is this thing targeting Ray Graff?
But ultimately, though, Jim, isn't the entire enslavement of the entire human race the ultimate end game here in 100 years?
So, you know, Ray, if I was going to be picking what are the things that are most likely to be the existential threats to humanity— AI is probably number, I don't know, 50.
Okay,
100.
Oh, good.
I mean, you know, our chances of killing ourselves through climate, our chance of, you know, poisoning ourselves with plastics, our chance of getting hit by a meteor, all those things worry me more than, you know, the Skynet.
Robots taking over and everything.
Yeah, the Skynet. Because, you know, we'd have to be pretty stupid to make these things without an off switch.
You know, you're remarkably sanguine, and I appreciate that. The number here is 800-348-2551. Before we take our next break, Marta in Poughkeepsie has been waiting a very, very long time. And I apologize, Marta. We've been blabbing.
Hi, Ray. No apology necessary.
Go
I was
ahead.
Getting educated.
You're on.
Okay. Just synchronicity. This past week or so, I saw a DVD called Max Headroom, spelled just like your head.
Yeah,
Headroom.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
It's from like 85, 87.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I never heard of it or saw it, but it's like everything you were talking about, it actually shows on that program. If anyone hasn't seen Max Headroom, and it sounds like you guys have.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're always
a big fan.
It's freaky. They talk about AI. They have this guy who's like, you know, this digital thing. And, I mean, they go right to the heart of the matter of the privacy issues, of the, you know, the subliminal manipulation of this massive takeover to get all your attention and controlling everything. And, you know, AI to me is big time scary. And microwaves, you know, I've told you before,
oh,
Ray,
yeah.
I'm extremely worried about being bombarded with radio frequency radiation 24/7. As far as I can tell, everybody's unraveling. So the smarter we get, the dumber we act.
Do you want to know something about radio waves? Marta, I can't say that there's a lot of science backing you up, but I remember watching Dave Letterman years and years ago, and he said, you know, society started to get bent when radio first started. And he said, I don't think it's the content. I think it's the actual radio waves. And this was, God, that had to be in the 90s. So you and Dave Letterman are kindred spirits on this one, Marta.
Yeah, but the microwaves weren't in the mix yet. And that metal bending thing, that was a little scary and spooky.
So,
and,
yeah,
you know, the thing about physics is it's all relative to what's relevant.
So, Marta,
and
let's get
I really
back.
Feel like you gave me a lot of time to say a lot. Thank you very much.
You got
no
it.
Problem. Let me get back to Max Headroom, which, by the way, for those of you who haven't seen it or don't know the joke, in England, where it was actually originally produced, whenever there's a low doorway, it says max headroom and then some number. So it's like our bridges that say 7'3". Yeah, yeah. So Max Headroom was a pun on that.
Yeah,
but you know, the scary thing, if you want to be scared, Marta, is the fact that Max Headroom, I mean, my grad students could build you something way better than Max Headroom. Not so much that in the physical world, but remember, Max Headroom was only on the video screen.
Yeah.
We have technologies now to get to that stuff much better. But a lot of these kind of things like Max Headroom and some of the movies and things like that have woken up people to the idea that we got to pay attention to this. And that's something I say all the time. It's humans making the right regulations, humans figuring out how to use this stuff right that matters. And if we just say to big tech, anybody who can, you know, anybody who has the money can do whatever the hell they want, then that scares me. But, you know, when any new technology comes along, people call it the end of society.
All right.
I remember when TV was going to be the end of society.
Have you looked at the latest AARP and all the warnings for us seniors about how not to get caught in that identity theft net?
Okay. Identity theft
net. Well, that's
net
a different
and
show.
Some of these other scams.
Yeah.
Yeah. When
all right,
we talk about that,
AI
we come
has
back.
A lot to do with it. Take care. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. We've got to take a break here. You know, the real problem with this whole business is there is a gradual melding of reality. And what is reality? What happened? Where's the line between real and not real? Only Jim Hendler knows. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. We're scared to death here by Jim Hendler. It's artificial intelligence. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Let me grab a couple. Go ahead.
Let me just say one thing, Ray, before you jump into that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on record again and again and again as saying the same thing. AI is not going to be the thing that kills us all. It's also not going to be the thing that saves us all. It's going to be an important technology and part of our technology space. It's going to be humans figuring out how to use this stuff. That's going to be what determines.
Like nuclear power, like nuclear weapons.
Because that's
worked out real well.
Yeah, and frankly, nuclear weapons have been, you know,
a sword of Damocles over our entire existence for 70 years.
Yeah, but for 70 years, they haven't been used. So,
no,
the way, I'd put them on our existential threat list
long before AI. Nuclear power,
I
think we can have that discussion. But, blowing things up, not a good thing.
Absolutely, and that's the thing. So how you use the technologies is a human thing.
Joe in Pittsfield writes, back in 2017, a fellow named Max Tegmark published a book entitled Life 3.0, in which he proposed an entirely possible outcome of unfettered AI development, a new form of human life which possesses the mechanisms of human cognition and the actual memories of selected conscious human and maintains those memories in an assembly of hardware designed with the assistance of other advanced AI that is essentially a technological embodiment of that actual human. Seemed to me that the author was trying to scare people into getting serious about putting the brakes on AI without having to appoint trusted humans in watchdog positions to keep an eye on AI progress. What's your opinion on Tegmark's prediction and on his advice?
So, Tegmark and some other people, I'm blanking on his name. Ray is his first name. So whenever I sit across from Ray, I can't remember.
No, Ray Graff. Yeah, it was his noted book on AI.
No. So, but talk about the singularity.
Right.
So, you know, you just take all these exponential curves of all the things going on in technology and say, hey, eventually we get to the point where the computer's smarter than us. We can just stick our brains into the computer.
Yeah.
There's people out in Tech Valley who have $1 billion who are, you know, working on making sure that they can live forever in a computer.
Right.
I still think that stuff's the stuff of science fiction because I sit down here in the trenches of this stuff trying to make things do really, you know, comparatively simple stuff. Now, we can make artificial people, but mostly we're doing it by just taking some real human and adding something or taking recordings or something out of their voices. You know, again, if you were listening to that previous show, you heard some of this. Face recognition. We can make, you know, we can take one person saying a set of words and someone else's voice in that set of words, and we can make the words come out in that second.
But are you being myopic, though? Is the wool over your eyes? Because, I mean, 100 years ago, who could have predicted that the computing power of they wouldn't even know what computing power was 100-plus years ago can be in your phone now?
So who 100 years ago would have figured out that my phone could show me movies that, by the way, back then movies were, you know, slides being moved very well. 100 years ago, we had the first
150, we'll say. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know when the first talkies came along. I'm sure
29-ish.
Yeah. So we'll call it 100 years. Okay. So again, but there were people who were saying this is, you know, now we're going to have these artificial people. We're going to have these people who are in movies who people think are real, and you know, people are going to be jumping off buildings because they think they're Superman and things. Like,
well, yeah.
You know, some of that happened a little bit, but mostly not. And I think most of us are pretty comfortable with that technology now, the TV, the streaming, the stuff like that. Radio was going to be a heck of a thing to kill us all. And if you don't include Rush Limbaugh, I think it's by and large been.
I'm sorry.
I apologize for that one.
But, mega dittos for that one. Well done. Hambone writes, In quantum physics, don't all things exist all at once? Wouldn't that make quantum computers near quantum or quantum-ish? Figure that one out, smart man.
So it's not all things occur all at once. It's certain combinations of certain things in certain ways superimpose and mesh. There's all this whole new vocabulary that, frankly, I'm still trying to learn. But the answer is yes, and we're trying to turn that to our advantage. But remember, we're talking about a little tiny bit of reality, right? To model a world in a quantum machine, I'd need, I don't know, how many bazillion qubits, right?
Now, a qubit is exactly what?
A qubit, when we talk about computers, we talk about bits.
Right.
Right. A qubit is the quantum equivalent, so it's something that's in a state that can become a one, a zero, or in some case, something else.
All right. It's not to the fourth power of a regular bit.
No, or anything like that. But combinations of them can do things. So you get, so having having a certain number of bits, we can have a certain number of combinations. Having a certain number of qubits, we can have way more combinations. But we also can only use them in certain ways. So there's a lot of discussion going on about that. And again, one of the things AI is trying to, we're trying to do with AI is see if we can figure out some of that stuff about what the quantum computer's doing. And part of what we're trying to do with quantum computers is figure out what these AI things are doing. So it's a fun world to live in because you get to talk to each other and hopefully figure some of this stuff out.
Can you imagine, like, this show should take 10 to 12 hours to do. Can you imagine how few people would be left listening if we did a full 10-hour discussion on this?
I have a former student who's really into this. I gave a book, you know, it's sort of the equivalent of Quantum for Dummies. And I said, you know, I've made it through page 5. I think you can read this thing. And he immediately started asking me questions. I'm like, look, read the book.
It's in the book, man.
And I'll read the book, and then maybe I can even understand the question you're asking. But these kids who are now college students, you know, when I started using computers, nobody in the whole world other than the few of us who were crazy, you know, computer science majors in universities really knew very much about computers.
Yeah.
Right? Now we all do. Right?
We think of them.
I mean, you're sitting there in front of a laptop, right? That laptop, you know, wouldn't have happened if we hadn't gone through all that other stuff
this
first.
This is a piece of junk, by the way. Take it back to the shop and see if we... Let's go to the phones again. Jonas has been waiting quite a while in Albany. Jonas, go ahead.
Hi there. This is Jonas. I'm a student at Albany Law School. I had a question. The International Court of Justice recently ruled that Israel's plausibly committing genocide in Gaza. I was wondering how do you respond to the significant role that AI is playing in the Palestinian context, particularly in Gaza, where it's being utilized for lethal purposes on a massive scale. If you consider, for example, Google and Amazon's $1.2 billion contract with the Israeli military through Project Nimbus.
All right. I can't even begin to start to answer that because, frankly, I'm going to disagree with almost everything you said. Not trying to make a political point, but technologically, the big tech companies are involved in every country. They're involved in all sorts of ways. You know, if you think the Hamas guys don't have access to pretty high and pretty good technology, you should have sat in on some of the National Security Agency briefings I used to be able to sit in on. I mean, you know, yes, during war now, we have cyber war, we have AI things being deployed. But right now, you look at that situation and it's the bombs that are doing the damage. Yeah. It's the terrorists that are doing the damage. It's the guns that are doing damage. It's the people not doing what humans normally should be doing to each other. So I'm sorry, I'm going to go moral on you rather than technological. Okay. And simply say, and frankly, the World Court didn't make that determination quite in the words you said. But
well, he's a lawyer.
But by and large, the answer is I think those two are removed from each other. I think there's issues about AI use in warfare. But for example, Google, Amazon, et cetera, are mostly doing for Israel what they're doing for us and everyone else, which is trying to make money off of using stuff. And, you know, the military uses it too. They build their own databases. They want to search their own databases. That's very different than when we start giving, you know, some particular kind of munitions to someone and we start doing, you know, making government decisions. So I don't think AI at the moment is a big player in that. I think there's a lot of other things at heart. I will say that Israel is a very strong company, a strong country when it comes to AI research, as are we, as is China, as is Russia. And frankly, in a lot of the war scenarios we see playing out, both going on and imagined, yeah, it's involved, but it's not. It's just a small piece of the much, much larger thing, because you do a lot more damage with a battleship than you do with an AI system.
At this time.
And I think for the foreseeable future.
Let's go to Peter in Albany. Peter, you're on.
Hello. There used to be an old movie, last first, if anyone saw it. I believe it was called Colossus, the Forbin Project.
Oh, yeah. Great.
Right. So I think the premise was, at the time, early in the 60s, computers just coming out. They weren't doing that well. But then they hooked up the U.S. computer to the Russian computer. They started communicating. And before they could, the computers thinking, as they do, faster than humans, said they've got to start to shut them off. But they said, if you shut us off, we're sending off the missiles.
Yeah.
So how do you, how could that not happen? Not just with AI, but with computers, obviously,
EMP.
Completely involved with how the missile system is set up.
Yeah. Well, EMP is so
electromagnetic pulse.
Ray threw out the idea of electromagnetic
That'll
pulse.
Get
you
rid
can
of
basically
a lot of problems.
Take down a computer with these things, but we're also now trying to build resistance to that.
Right.
But anyway,
harden them up.
You know, I actually teach a course, or taught a course, now it's being taught by someone else, called AI and Fiction and Fact. Yeah. And we actually watched some of the old AI movies, and then we looked at some of the new AI programming, and we kind of compared where did people's opinion, you know, you look at a newspaper story, you say, you know, which kind of archetype is that coming from? Is that coming from the friendly computer, Robbie, who is in Forbidden Planet? Is that coming from the awesome robot, not Gorp, but
Gorp. I have no idea.
No. It's in Forbidden Planet.
Oh yeah, I love that movie. But I forget the name.
Day of the Earth Stood Still.
Right.
You know, I mean, again and again. So we went through from like old movies to newer movies, and then we compared them to reality. And the answer is, you know, we're nowhere near there yet. And the movies turn out to play cautionary roles. You know, it's very interesting. As when I first started working with military people, you know, we would go, we went to the Strategic Air Command, and they actually showed us a piece of a Hollywood film that showed how some people had basically stolen a piece of nuclear technology. Mm. They said, you know, when we watched that film, we got scared. We realized some of what those guys did was possible. So we've changed things. Now it's impossible.
Interesting.
That way. So, you know, we've learned stuff from those movies and things like that. And, you know, I'm not too worried about the computers all talking to each other and taking over. Because, frankly, we don't know how to do that. Yeah, I mean, you know, these things move fast, but so do you. You know, humans may move slow, but we still are pretty smart.
Okay.
And hopefully, you know, again, we're killing ourselves by other means.
All right.
I don't think the AI is.
Either way, we die. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Hopefully, we live.
All right, let's go to John in Scotia. Maybe he has something uplifting to say. John, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Quick as an intro, yeah, I remember, you know, high school, we just started my last year using calculators. But bringing it all the way forward in the 70s, all the way through, I was a product manager for semiconductor for capital equipment. You know, we were developing, we were helping in the development of technology used in, Pentium 1, Pentium 2, Pentium 3, when we exceeded the technology that was capable of doing it with aluminum and all the rest of it. But anyway, the when I'm looking at all this in the development, we were talking about quantum computers and going to the lame person's kind of perspective. If everybody remembers where we started on computers, which was in, 70s, 80s, when we really started getting into it. 70s, 80s, they were dumb. And now they go faster and faster and faster. And as we developed, you know, the quantum is the next generation where you can't even fathom how fast they go and how much information they acquire. I mean, that's really the basic premise.
Yeah.
And to go faster, you got to go smaller, as you're talking about nanotechnology or micro and all the rest of it. And you have to get colder because things move faster. If you think of electrons moving or whatever, that's where your two technology you were talking about in the big disk down in cold.
Yep.
That's where that all comes into. So anyway, the second part of that was
only got about 30 seconds
because I'm so old. I do remember all the technology and I did take courses in a long time ago and scientists kind of follow along. Engineers and scientists kind of follow along. Dreamers like Isaac Asimov, many, many years ago, came up with the various technologies that we're facing today. Engineers put it to life.
Yep.
So what we're talking about now is AI.
And a lot of that science fiction had warnings in it that we should be paying attention to. But you got to tell the reality from the fiction. And that's actually what the course I designed was all about, was trying to get some students to understand what we really can do with these things and what we can't. You know, Ray and I have a Food Friday coming up.
That's right. We only have 30 seconds. Let's do the
May 3rd. May 3rd.
May 3rd. That's
right. You send in some ingredients, and we're going to have ChatGPT figure out a recipe
for
you.
And so,
and then Ray is going to have a real chef who's going to comment on those.
That's correct. So basically, you look in your fridge, you find a few ingredients, maybe your cupboard or whatever, you can email them now to voxpop@wamc.org anytime between now and May 3rd. Jim will be here manning the computer. We'll put those ingredients in to the AI bot or whatever they call it, and it's going to come out with recipes. And then Chef Gail Sokol will take a look at the recipe and say, that stinks. That's not a good one. So that'll be fun. That is coming up on May 3rd. Jim Hendler, great job. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Ray, as always.
Support comes from the Tang Teaching Museum at Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. And the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting their Earth Day event with volunteer projects for children, adults, and community groups this Saturday from 9 to noon, albanypinebush.org. Once again, thanks to Jim Hendler for being here. He's gearing up for the big Food Friday AI Recipe Help Desk edition on May 3rd. And so he's got to rest up, obviously. Thanks, Jim. Thanks to everybody who called in. Thanks to everybody listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. He is completely analog, this guy. He's a natural intelligence, no artificiality. Thanks to Lightning Eddie Rosen, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, boy, if you've been listening to this show, you're going to want to get out of Dodge. We'll do travel with Gene Gagnon tomorrow at 2. We'll see you for that.